not as much of a pull as you'd like to get, because that last month is in the next year. In terms of the way they report it.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, and you'll be meeting with people individually today, and then also this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you, very good.
See you.
Yeah, the Finance Committee is recessed until 8:30 tomorrow morning. Friday, April 21st. Senators that are here, Senator Fisher, Senator Binkley, Senator Zuroff, Senate Bill number 119 on relating to an act relating to requiring reporting methods for corporate income taxes owed by members of the affiliated group whose common parent is a corporation incorporated outside the United States. First bill of the day. And why don't we go ahead and take our testimony from the teleconference. We have a couple people online.
Mr. Wada from Kyoto.
Okay, we'll go ahead and take Mr. Wada.
People Tokyo?
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Wada.
Yes.
Kyoto.
Kyoto. In Kyoto.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. My name is Chris Wada. I'm a senior vice president of the Sony Corporation of America. And I thank you very much to the great chairman and the union and the members the opportunity to testify. Not only on behalf of Sony, but all Japanese industries embodied in Kenny Thunder. We are very much gratified and happy that you can be taking up with this S-118. Sony and all Japanese industries to support immediate and as quick as possible passage with 118, not only for you, Japanese industries are very kind of Oscar. Great President Westbrook, the ring for the sake of the state of Alaska. The union has to represent risk back for all international investments, particularly for Japanese. We have seen all the problems from you, Jaita. You guys have the means, the worldwide company that you guys have the means, double taxation. It means unfair tax treatment. It means unlawful tax treatment. It means a tax system not respected around the world. No state, no country, except as the state of Alaska, still continues to exercise this worldwide combination with its tax. We strongly recommend that your committee evaluate and pay us the debt 119. We have been carefully watching, and we have noted state legislature
unitary tax.
A committee on the judiciary, a committee on resources, passed a bill more than a month and a half ago. Since then, it has not moved. Knowing that your legislature will be in the May 9th, we are seriously concerned under what would state of rule the legislature on the state of Alaska has serious interest to eliminate the Utah tax from Alaska. Repeal of the Utah tax would mean international investment, jobs, Did you ever do any tests? Who is the top radio? That much is the case of the industry. At least, the reasons are good enough for you. You know what to say. I will do all the things.
Results in economic double taxation, the enormous difficulties in
confirmed to translation, judgment of county differences, and establishes the value of historical invested capital in terms of the common currency. It is a problem that clearly discourages investment in any economy to the sum of immediate and very large off-site reward. Given the choice between states that offer similar economic incentives, the one that uses water data for separate accounting for tax purposes will surely be the better located. If Alaska moves to attract European investment, enactment of the bill will be a large step toward providing favorable reception for that investment. Alaska is now really the only remaining state that mandates worldwide combined. And the sentiment we would thank for anyone who's looking to invest in a new place, one of the first things you're going to check to see is, do you have that kind of tax system and is it going to cause a great deal of difficulty? Even California, which is one of the principal advocates of worldwide buying and apportioning, now permits taxpayers to elect out of it. We strongly urge Alaska to rid itself of this invidious distinction and adopt the water-fish method that is proposed in the Senate bill as if you now have it. I think that expresses our views, and I don't want to get too technical about it, but I think that we're strongly opposed to the system that you now have, and we certainly hope that you can act as well.
Any questions for Mr. Carter? Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Carter.
Thank you very much for letting me testify.
Okay. And the other person on teleconference is Mr. Bill Knoll in Seward.
Yes, this is Bill Knoll. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and other committee members. Thank you very much for the opportunity of testifying on Senate Bill 119 this morning. I'm testifying as Vice President of Sunny Alaska Corporation and as President of Alaska Korea Business Council, a not-for-profit corporation, long established in Alaska. We very strongly support Senate Bill 119 and urge its passage by Senate Finance Committee and by the Senate, and in fact by the legislative body. Investments are automatically limited here in the state of Alaska by the mere presence of such a centralized unitary tax law. I would care not to repeat the kind of testimony that both Sisters Awana and Mr. Carter have so well expressed, but rather say that through my personal experience and through our business experience at Sunil and through our contacts at Alaska Korea Business Council, I can assure you that those sentiments are not false sentiments, they're not mockery, they're very real sentiments that are felt very strongly and deeply by those ordinary businessmen overseas who are looking for a place to do business. International business is excellent business. State of Alaska, we do a lot of it, as you are, I'm sure, very well aware. A couple of $1 billion a year. And as foreign businesses, foreign investments make good business here, they make good neighbors here, as I think it's been able to demonstrate throughout the state every quarter. Our immediate concern, as far as our company is concerned, is Sunil, which is the owner and operator of the Seward Coal Terminal. We know specifically of a concern regarding the unitary tax by a Japanese developer of a prospective coal mine in the Manchester Valley. It is a Kosar, which is a very fine, well-established, and I might add, very profitable international oil company and energy company. Has been prospecting, drilling, and is now underway with a very deep-rated feasibility study because of the moving of some coal mine in a traditional historic coal mining area called Wishbone Hill. That will be, should that feasibility prove positive and the project go forward, that would be more than doubling our coal exports from Alaska today. jobs that are up on. There are some 150 to 200 jobs immediately in the Palmer area. More than doubling in terms of the Alaska Railroad transportation down to Seward to the port. And of course, the increased activity here at the Arrow Intensive Seward Coal Tunnel. We're eagerly looking forward to that. I know personally that the representatives of residents of Coast Island have approached the governor and have approached the director of the Office of International Trade, expressing a desire to be rid of the chance that this small, relatively small venture in terms of business to Coast Island, both my revenues, very important to us. This relatively small venture in the Madison Valley would somehow have an avenue back into their worldwide revenues. I think anyone could appreciate that concern. As Mr. Wyatt had earlier testified, there are real Japanese businessmen, as well as Korean and others in Europe, who do have legitimate concerns. I'd like to cut short this testimony. I think our position is well established in other testimony of the Senate Committee. We thank you very, very much for your time, and again, urge your swift passage of Senate Bill 119. I'll be here for any questions. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Bill. Any questions for Bill Noel?
Okay, no questions now at this time.
Thank you, Bill. Next person to testify is Larry Deneen in Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Today I am representing Mayor Tom Fink, Mayor of Anchorage, Ports Alaska, which represents the majority of the ports in all of Alaska, as co-chairman, and chairman of the Resource Development Council Committee on International Trade and Industrial Policy. From personal experience in Oregon and relative experience in California, I can corroborate the statement of Mr. Wada and Mr. Carter that the unitary tax is not only a double taxation, it tremendously interferes in the normal processes of doing business and figuring how you are to implement and pay the tax, but it's a deep cultural opposition to investment. In California, they call it a special session of the legislature when $250 billion foreign exchange was available for investment from Japan to the world. The California governor, the Canadian, and the legislature were informed that if California retained the unitary tax, they would share in none of that investment. The governor called a special session of the legislature and in 30 hours turned that around. In the state of Oregon, senators, Governor Picatia was informed by the Japanese that if he got rid of the unitary tax in Oregon, there would be four plants the next day. The governor of Oregon, Picatia, called a special single-item section of the legislature again in 24 hours. They turned it around. The four plants were announced. It's now 12 plants and about $1 billion worth of investment and the potential of 8,000 employees. Ports Alaska seeks investment in infrastructure and docks, harbors, wharves, water systems, the waste disposal systems so they can handle the product that's coming over. They need major investments. The major Pacific Rim countries are interested in making those investments. Industry is a major impediment for their consideration. So it's tourism, recreation, fisheries, forest products, transportation, metallurgy, and the foreign trade zone license that Anchorage will soon receive all would be hurt by the continuance of the unitary tax. We did corroborate definitely that it is a double taxation, that its impact is very difficult to process here in Alaska, and most states admit that now, that they can't figure it out, so that both parties understand. We're the only state in the union that still retains it. It is a major impediment, both from a fiscal, a figuring point of view, a psychological point of view, and a cultural point of view. And for us to be working so hard to get new economic development in the state, and to have to face this impediment almost the first question we get asked in foreign countries, is a real problem for us, and we hope you will pass Senate Bill 119. Again, this is from the Mayor of Anchorage, Ports of Alaska, and the Resource Development Council. We have worked on these, on this subject for about 7 years, and we hope you can consider it quickly and do some very good action to correct it. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Any questions? No questions at this time. Lauren Lonsberry.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm also here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 119 to modify the unitary tax. I'll not go into details of the bill, as you all are well aware of the bill itself. I've been working in international trade for many years, both in government and in private practice. In fact, I just returned last Saturday from a week in Korea. As Larry has indicated, among the questions that I am most frequently asked is when discussing Alaska as a foreign investment, is what are the state government regulations on foreign corporations doing business in Alaska, and probably the most asked question, of course, is about our unitary tax, and why are we still working under that impediment. As you are aware, and has been testified, we are the only state with unitary tax, and this, of course, is a matter that virtually all foreign countries are aware of. Other states realize the limiting effect of the tax, what it was doing to foreign investment in their states. They very rapidly removed it, and subsequently have seen marked improvement in their economy because of overseas investment. Of course, modifying a unitary tax alone will not create a situation where foreign companies will come flocking to our door, but it is a major, major step in that direction. The present unitary tax gives the perception foreign business that we really don't want them here. And perception is very, very important to foreign companies. I think that during Senator Ewing's long time interest in international trade, he has discovered the same thing about the importance of foreign perception to our reception to them in our state. Because of that, and of course all of the other reasons that I testified to, I would strongly urge your committee pass out SB 119 as soon as possible, so the full Senate can pass the bill and send it along to the House for passage, hopefully this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lauren. Mr. Richard Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rich Carson. I'm a managing partner of Coopers and Lybrand's Alaska operation. I'm also a member of the board of the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce. The Anchorage Chamber represents over 1,200 member businesses. Chambers long supported economic development incentives for business, not merely the development of the existing businesses, but the introduction of new business. In fact, the Chamber has one of its legislative priorities, the establishment of business development incentives. SB 119 does a good job providing incentives to support business development. The unitary tax concept is one that they must scrap, and it must be scrapped for all business, not just foreign corporations. The state, in reviewing its long-term plans for economic development, must be evaluated tax policies. As stated earlier, by earlier testimony, last year was one of the last to consider reviewing the unitary tax. It must be done. It must be done for all who would invest in Alaska. As one of many steps in a larger project tax policy that would ward off new business investment in Alaska. The chamber supports the passage of SB 119, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Carson. Any questions from the audience? No questions. Anybody else on the teleconference line at this time? Okay, at this time we're going to go off the teleconference line and then go here to Juneau. Thank you all for your testimony this morning. Okay, here in Juneau, anybody to testify on Senate Bill 119? Mr. Kirk, have you signed up? Mr. McVie?
I thought I'd signed up.
I have a sheet that has two signed up. Yeah. Why don't you put your hand up? Mr. McVie?
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kurt McVie, the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association, and we'd like to express our support for SB 119. It's a kind of legislation that accomplishes what we have advocated within the Miners Association, and that is an incentive for business. But we'd like to support it with an amendment that puts domestic corporations on the same tax footing as foreign corporations. Currently, much of the mineral development in Alaska is by foreign corporations, and we certainly encourage the continuation of their interest and expertise, but not at the expense of our own domestic mining companies. We need to encourage both. We need to look at incentives which can diversify Alaska's economic base. We need to think long-term. Granted, there may be a small immediate loss of revenue, but those who take the high risk in developing mineral properties must look 10 to 20 years ahead. It is incumbent on government to also look at the future, not just satisfy an immediate shortfall. I don't know if there's been any economic analysis conducted on the decrease of investment by U.S.-based companies, but suggest, if not, that this might be an order. It is indeed logical to assume U.S.-based companies would prefer to invest in the U.S. where they know the system. This should not be discouraged. Dollars retained in the U.S. mean jobs. SB 119, as proposed, will further constrain U.S.-based companies. We recommend that it be amended and passed, thus providing an incentive bringing investment from both domestic and foreign sources. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. McVie. Questions? Same questions. Next person to testify is Susan Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Susan Burke. I'm a lawyer here in Juneau, and I'm here today representing the IBM Corporation. IBM, in general, favors the concept of amending Alaska's corporate income tax laws to repeal the requirement of worldwide combination and permitting water's edge reporting. We see, however, a fundamental flaw in the governor's approach to this bill because it provides for water's edge combination and accounting only for corporations who happen to have foreign parents. Now, Mr. Wada and Mr. Carter and Mr. Knoll and various people that you've heard today have gone through all of the reasons why worldwide combination is problematic, both in terms of the specific problems that it causes corporations, but more importantly, I think, because of the strong message that it sends to potential investors about whether or not Alaska really wants these corporations to come in and do business here and invest their money here. Every single one of those arguments applies, at least with equal force, to domestically owned multinational corporations. And this really isn't surprising that the same arguments should apply, because when you come right down to it, There is absolutely no difference between a company like IBM, for instance, or some other domestic multinational corporations, and the Sony Corporation, except for the fact that one has a foreign parent and one has a domestic parent. And in our view, providing worldwide combination for foreign corporations only is very discriminatory. There's no real difference between these corporations. And furthermore, when you're talking about corporations that are virtually indistinguishable except for their parentage, you're talking about providing quite a competitive advantage to the foreign corporations and, coincidentally, of course, a competitive disadvantage to domestic multinational corporations who were doing the same kind of business. The primary objection that the governor's office has testified to in previous hearings on this bill, to including the domestic multinationals, is simply on the basis of revenue. They wanted this bill to be revenue neutral, and if you include roughly revenue neutral, and if you included domestic multinationals, there would be an increased fiscal note. I'd like to say a couple of things about that. It is perfectly legitimate and perfectly good tax policy for a legislative body to say, yes, you know, we like revenue, we need revenues here, and we're not going to change our tax laws because to do so would result in a loss of too much revenue. But it makes no sense to make a change in the tax laws, in the basic tax policy, for some taxpayers and not for others who are similarly situated. It's as if to say we think repealing a certain tax law makes good sense, basically, but we can't afford to give it to everybody. So we're going to provide this tax break and encourage investment only from taxpayers who are left-handed. We just can't afford to provide it to the right-handed taxpayers. Now, in my view, that does not make for good tax policy. When you're dealing with tax policies, I think it's important that you deal with similarly situated taxpayers in an even-handed way. And unfortunately, the governor's bill, as presently drafted, simply does not do that. Let me talk for a minute about the revenue, the revenues. The governor's office in the Department of Revenue has talked about a potential revenue loss to the state of between $3 and $6 million if domestic multinationals are included. To begin with, I don't think the department has done a careful study or careful review of this. My understanding is this is sort of an eyeball figure, and frankly, I think it is an eyeball figure very, very much on the high side. But beyond that, even assuming if it is $2 or $3 million, in the big picture, that really isn't that much money. Now, I realize that you're all sitting up here every day agonizing and struggling over a state budget that many of you think is too big, and you are trying to find areas in which to cut the budget and spend less money, and I understand that. On the other hand, you are still going to appropriate an awful lot of money for an awful lot of things that, in your view, do make good economic sense and are good things for the state to be spending its money on. Now, it seems to me that when we're in a situation with oil revenues falling, although they're rising at the moment, so maybe it's more appropriate to say a situation where oil revenues are in a volatile kind of state, it seems to me that it's even more critical to do whatever you can do in a responsible way to encourage diversification of the economy and to reduce the dependence on oil revenues. And it seems to me that one very good way to do that is to deal with this one area of the tax law that is just as much of a red flag to domestic multinational corporations as it is to the foreigns. As has been stated before, Alaska now is the only state in the union that requires this worldwide combination. And, you know, Alaska has to do an awful lot of selling to any corporation in order to encourage investment here. And if you have this one impediment still in place for domestic multinationals, it's going to be even more difficult to encourage investment by those groups. So, if you view the revenue loss, potential revenue loss here, as an expenditure, it seems to me that it makes very good economic sense for this body to expend a couple of million dollars in what is in essence an investment in the future and development. We're talking jobs here, and as Mr. Wada mentioned, more jobs, and ultimately, as the economy expands, you make that revenue up in more corporate income taxes, done, of course, on a water's edge basis. Now, I've heard this morning pleas for haste and speedy action on this bill from a lot of people, and I guess I would take the other tack and urge that you take take this with a somewhat slower pace. You're talking here about a change in a pretty fundamental and basic tax policy, and you're considering a bill that, in my view, has substantial problems with regard to simply fundamental fairness in terms of treating taxpayers equally. And that, it seems to me, is a policy that ought not to be adopted lightly and shouldn't be adopted hastily. The other thing is that many companies really haven't, domestic multinational companies who either are currently doing business in Alaska or who may potentially think they may want to do business here, really have not had an opportunity to analyze this bill and look at it and come forward and share their thoughts with you. What I can say is that the support for the IBM amendment, which would include domestic multinationals, support for that is definitely growing. The State Chamber of Commerce, you have the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce here today, the Alaska Miners Association, Mr. Horace Hunt, I've been talking to in the last couple of days. He was hoping to be here himself today to speak to you. I don't know whether he was able to do that, from the Brown & Root Company. Brown & Root believes that if this bill is going to make any sense at all, it must include the domestic multinationals as well. The other problem is we don't even have accurate numbers on the revenue side of this with regard to domestic multinationals. In summary, I would urge very strongly that the legislature adopt the amendment to the unitary tax, but only if domestic multinationals are included as well. And if you don't feel in a position to be able to do that now, I would urge the committee at least to hold off taking any action on the bill until such time as the committee has had a chance really to review and think about some pretty serious policy questions that are raised by the governor's bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Susan.
Any questions?
Any questions? Senator Fisher?
Not a question, but if you look, Mr. Chairman, at all the people who signed, I'm talking to senators through the committee system, and what's glaring out there is either no record, do not pass, and why would they, I know you can't second guess them, but if this thing is as good as it is, you wouldn't expect to see that. So
I think that's a rhetorical question, perhaps. Do you really want me to try to? I can't answer it, Senator Fisher.
No, I know you can't, but it's just, you know, and yet I see one that went from a, went the other way. One went from, I think, a do not pass to a do pass. You know, the thing went through the system. So maybe what you're saying is more people need to get in and look at it.
I think that's correct, yeah. Yes.
Senator Fisher, I can tell you that in the Judiciary Committee, the discussion centered around the fact that everyone thought it was an excellent idea that had a lot of merit, and at that time we thought we had a $600 million deficit. And no one wanted to put a due pass on something that would have increased that deficit. Yeah. That's no longer the case.
Okay, so they were concerned about what $60,000 is helping that deficit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
And the specter of it being larger than that.
Okay.
And so you saved money in judiciary.
Yeah. I know.
Every penny counts.
Are we still on the teleconference?
I don't know.
No.
No.
Good. I just had a question there. How many domestic companies are looking at developing in Alaska?
I can't tell you for certain. For one thing, you know, there may be companies out there, you know, who are thinking about it that I'm not aware of, and it's difficult to find them. You know, this is not a bill that has attracted an awful lot of attention, even in the business community, which frankly surprises me. I think it's something that I think people are just beginning to become aware of it.
Okay.
So I cannot give you an example of any company that would invest, if only, in a very specific way. And quite frankly, I haven't heard, you know, I've heard some vague suggestions that there are foreign companies that, you know, that may want to do this, if only. But I haven't heard any really concrete proposals, such as the 12 plants in Oregon that will go in tomorrow, if only you make this change. I think what I am hearing from these groups is precisely what I'm telling you, is that unless you make the change, you are sending a very negative message to both foreign investors and domestic investors.
Mr. Chairman.
I guess the concern I have is when I take a look at who has the greatest interest in developing Alaska or investing in the development of Alaska, it has not been American-based corporations.
That's true.
I don't see American corporations interested in developing coal, for example, jumping in Alaska and saying we want to develop coal. Or in fisheries. I don't see anybody coming in and developing fisheries from the domestic side. It isn't there. I mean, there's more to do elsewhere than I guess what Alaska has to offer them at this time. And it appears to me that the foreign investors, particularly in the Pacific Rim, have seen the value of what Alaska can provide.
Well, part of the reason for that, of course, is that for the last 10 years, Alaska has been actively selling. I don't think that, to my knowledge, we don't have a state office in Kansas City or New York, and Alaska simply hasn't been active in developing that kind of market. Perhaps if it were more active in doing so, you would see more of that kind of activity.
Senator Pierce?
I think my question is probably more for the administration than for the witness, but of the other 49 states who have all changed their tax system, how many of them have made a unitary tax that would affect only foreign companies versus affecting U.S. companies also?
My understanding is none.
And everybody else does both. That's your understanding?
That's my
is
understanding.
That your understanding?
Yes, ma'am. And there's a lot of distinctions, which we'll be happy to address.
Mr. Erickson, what was your comment? I'm sorry.
I'm just concurring in the affirmative answer that Susan gave you.
Okay. Is there any other questions for Susan? Do you have any possible amendments for the bill or anything at this point?
I do.
Do we have that so the chair could be advised on these amendments?
You may.
We won't. Just as long as
yeah, maybe I can just. Right yeah, I can leave it with Carol.
Okay. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Next person to testify is Greg Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greg Erickson. I'm an economist with the Policy Division in the Governor's Office. You have in front of you black, I think, books in which the briefing materials provided by the administration are contained. I think it's in the that's it, too, it looks like. We've discussed this bill in several committees, three in passing through the Senate, and I don't think I'll take time to reiterate the things I said there. I would like to, however, read a statement from Governor Cooper. Quote, I want to reiterate my strong belief that foreign investment in Alaska is being unnecessarily impeded by the unitary tax provisions of our current corporate income tax. I note that SB 119, as currently drafted, has virtually no effect on state revenues. Passing this legislation is the one thing we can do this session that will improve the state's business climate without any significant budget impact. I urge your prompt and favorable consideration of this legislation. Unquote. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Burke made her usual excellent presentation, and it's basically an issue as she describes it, I think. On the one hand is a proposal here that we believe, Governor Cooper believes, will bring substantial foreign investment into the state. On the other hand is a proposal which will also bring substantial foreign investment into the state, but which is going to cost $3 to $6 million by our estimate. And our estimate was in part derived from information provided by Ms. Burke's client, IBM. That's the long and the short of it, we think, and we urge your prompt and favorable consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson.
Senator Fisher? Just a question. I mean, we keep hearing it's a psychological barrier. Greg, would by changing this, would it deter any domestic company from investing in the state at all?
We see absolutely no basis for any domestic company to be deterred. For 10 years, at least a decade now, foreign parent companies, companies with foreign parents and foreign companies have been coming to us and to other states and saying, this is a problem. We have not heard until just this year that any domestic company had a problem with the type of tax regime that is currently applied to them. The fiscal note suggests that this is not going to be a significant tax break to foreign companies. If anything, they may end up paying more taxes in some instances. It is a tax break, clearly, as applied to domestic companies. And it's distinction, there's no question about that, between foreign and domestic companies, but it's a kind of distinction that we make in our tax laws all the time. It's not between left-handed and right-handed taxpayers. That kind of distinction would clearly be arbitrary and inappropriate. It's a distinction of the sort that we make between oil taxpayers and non-oil taxpayers, or between transportation taxpayers and non-transportation taxpayers, and so forth. So we have heard none of these objections until it became clear that there was a possibility of a tax break being granted, I think.
Next bill is 119, which was given to, if I'm not mistaken, Senator Pierce and myself. I believe there's an amendment on it. There's no controversy.
191.
I'm sorry. An act relating to employment contributions and to the establishment of employment training programs and providing for an effective date. We have an amendment from Senator Kelly. See if it's in order here. It should be under the memo dated April 20th from the Office of the President.
It's the latest military amendment.
The latest Alaska National Guard amendment
what?
Here.
He loves it.
Department of Military Veterans may administer training and pre-employment training.
Right.
Senator
Pierce.
I have a question about the amendment.
Okay.
If we could have Mr. Plasman come forward.
Sir?
He's from CNRS.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jim Plasman from Department of Community and Regional Affairs.
Go ahead.
Would you like to be introduced?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, you had a question about the amendment?
Well, yes. I don't understand how this would work. Does this mean that you would have to RSA money that you've taken from people's unemployment insurance, transfer it over to military affairs, and they would train who to do what?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, this amendment would not involve the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs in the fiscal impact of this legislation at all. I see Dave Gray from Senator Kelly's office is here, and he perhaps would be able to speak more comprehensively to the amendment, but I believe that the intent of the amendment is to provide authority to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to receive federal funds from like Department of Defense, which currently we, like our department, would not be able to do.
So they would set up their own program with their own federal funds? This is just authorization?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, that's correct.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Does the department
Pierce?
Support this?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, yes, we do.
Your head's back there in the crowd.
Senator Fisher.
No, Mr. Chairman, I guess the question that I have is the emphasis just going to be on putting people to work doing projects, or is the emphasis going to be on job training that after the work they can get employment doing what they've been trained to do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, in relation to the amendment here?
Yes. No, I'm sorry, to the whole, I'm sorry, maybe we should be just addressing the amendment. But let's just address the amendment with the military and Veterans Affairs. Is it going to be just on the downside, providing work for people and no real training that would give them a saleable skill after the work's
yeah.
over?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I believe the emphasis will be to provide training that will be saleable in the future. I, again, would defer to Dave Gray to give a more comprehensive answer in that regard.
Mr. Gray, you want to come forward?
He's been here for half an hour. I've smiled all I can.
For the record, my name is Dave Gray. I'm a
why did they want to picture me?
To the chair, in answer to the senator's question, the idea is, and what Department of Military and Veterans Affairs can really do and assist is their program is aimed at kids between 17 and 20 years old, particularly those that maybe in a rural situation where coming out of high school, not with maybe a lot of skills and that, but if indeed that there are projects, more of a CCC type project, maybe an agreement with Division of Parks on a project near a rural area, something like that, to bring those people into a disciplined kind of a organization to go out and do things, whether it's building trails or something like that. The Department of Military and Veterans Affairs do not view themselves as getting heavily into the job training and skills area. There's other agencies in the state that are involved in that sort of thing. But there is some real ability for them to, in the future, if they have some success with this kind of thing, to be able to steer young people into these other job training type things with federal funds, military, particularly military funds. There's a lot of interest shown by Senator Inouye in his trip here in Alaska last fall, this past summer, and this kind of stuff. Senator Inouye is on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. There has been recently interest by Senator Sam Nunn in similar kinds of civil service programs. And the General Schaefer is very interested in trying to see what the possibilities are. And to do that, he has to have the enabling legislation, the ability to try it out. And that's the purpose of Senator Kelly's amendment here, is that the bill, Senate Bill 191, speaks to a lot of other things. Senator Kelly's amendment does not add a program that gets into the money side of the fiscal part of 191. Senator Kelly's amendment is just to add enabling legislation on a convenient title.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my concern is that they don't, in other words, don't supplant existing military personnel. In other words, if the existing military personnel, I'm going to use some examples of shining or cleaning down equipment and things, that these people aren't brought on to free up military personnel to do something else or to do nothing, And the other concern I would have is if it's a training program as the first step for a real occupation like Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, is this going to be kind of part of it too, that this is kind of the cadet, the introduction, and then hopefully that they sign up to go for 4 years or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, at this stage, there is that element, but there is not going to be anything in this program that says that somebody that wants to partake of it is in some kind of pre-commitment to military service, nor is the program designed for men only, type thing. Is that one gap there between 17 and 20 years old, you know, that the Department of Veterans Affairs thinks that they may be uniquely suited because they have the personnel that they can bring up, and they have the logistics ability to support some of these things, engineers and so on. But it's not in any way an effort to supplant other kinds of programs that deal with job training.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Pierce?
Yeah. Have the education requirements for coming into the National Guard been changed lately? Do you have to have a higher education than you did a couple of years ago?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to the question, I understand that one of the interests in this thing that answer the question is no, but I know that that is a difficulty with the National Guard in recruiting, that some of the people that come in do not have sufficient skills. I mean, even out of high school, I think there's been other discussions of high school performance, graduates and stuff like that. So they do view as this program is possibly getting into some remedial education type thing, so that people can get up to standard in whatever they choose, whether it's if they choose to go into the National Guard or go into some other occupation. These are all elements that they would like to weave into the possible program.
And
Senator,
does this
Pierce
come with the $120,000 disconnect that's in the last page of Senator Kelly's backup materials?
Mr. Chairman, that is not necessarily a fiscal note. That was kind of a response to an inquiry. Whether that's exactly how they will do a program like that, I'm not certain. Certainly we're not putting that out as a fiscal note or a particular program. Certainly it's going to impact the fiscal on this bill.
So
we were talking about enabling legislation.
Okay, so we're only going to do the enabling legislation, then we're going to let Military and Veterans Affairs figure out how to do it. Or Senator Kelly figure out how to do it. We could sell more license plates.
Something. The year of the license plate. I like it. Okay. Anybody else here to testify on the bill? Okay, the bill is before us. Committee Substitute Present Bill Number 191, Community Regional Affairs. Senator,
and just one final question. Can senior centers get funded here to train people?
Could
a senior center, and it just dawned on me because I'm seeing what's happening to the budget this year, can a senior center say, look, we have some youth that we want to train?
What kind
of thing happening to seniors? Well, what do you mean? We're talking about job training. Could the seniors qualify as a job training organization?
Chairman, Senator Fisher, Mark Mickelson with Community and Regional Affairs. A senior center probably could apply as long as they had people that fit the eligibility that's detailed under,
yeah, they,
you know, under that section. Oh, okay. So they would be able to.
Yeah,
you're
good. Okay.
Great. Yeah. Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was
We've had this bill before. I was ready to make a motion to incorporate the amendment into a committee substitute.
Your motion would be in order.
I move that we prepare a finance committee substitute for Senate Bill number 191 that would incorporate the amendment proposed by Senator Kelly.
Okay.
Is there any question about these two topics being kind of totally different and being put into the same bill? Has that been checked?
And change the title for you.
Okay. We're getting an affirmative head nod that yes, it's been checked, so it must work. Okay.
Any objection to that? Go pass it out.
They're going to train them, right?
That was just to adopt it.
That was adopted.
Okay. Senator Duncan? Senator Tesoro?
No, please. I would move to report the committee substitute out of committee.
Okay.
We're
taking at ease right now. The media is in order today. It's Saturday, April 22nd. Senator Zaroff, Senator Fisher, Senator Binkley, Senator Pierce are here. First bill up on the calendar is going to be an act providing for rent royalty payments for mining claim leasehold location. Do we have our resources chairman here to testify on the bill? Mr. Bill Glued want to testify on the bill?
Do you want to try?
I have a yes now.
Chairman, I confer with the elected resources chair.
Okay.
There she is.
Hey, this is the first bill. Come on, John.
Senator Barringham.
Hey, did you get my thing for that Miss America thing? Hey, yeah, see, it is happening in the past. We like calling back home to say that.
Senator Barringham.
Good morning, Chairman. Good morning, Senator. Good morning, Senator.
Senator Farencamp, we do have a committee substitute before us. Would you like to go through the bill with us to make sure that it's in proper order?
I'll be happy to, Mr. Chairman. You'll notice on your Finance Committee substitute there is a change of title from the tight title to the act relating to mining and the effective date. You'll find that this piece of legislation is substantially different from the legislation that came from the Resources Committee. It's a result of a great deal of work as to trying to reach agreement with what people can live with and still try to meet the needs of as many as possible. In this piece of legislation, you'll find that the three questions that I brought to you before, which was how much, what, and how much, and the reclamation question. In this piece of legislation, rather than the 6I A and B lands that were designated by the courts, due to the difficulties in trying to determine the metal and content character, we had gone to all state lands, including submerged lands. You'll also find in here that you have rents that escalate from 50 cents up to $2.50 after 11 years. You have royalties that are 3% of net rents that will cease when royalties start to be paid. You have an escalation clause on rents that ties it with the Anchorage CPA, and that's in order to try to prevent just sheer speculation and not developing the resources of the state. you'll find that in the reclamation area, which is added and necessitated the change in title, that the reclamation reflects that there will be, by the end of session next year, a study done on reclamation and exactly what the policy of the state would be, in that we did not, by any stretch of the imagination, have time to address that this year. It's and it along with that goes my word that the Resources Committee and the word of the House Resources that we will be working on that during the interim and coming back to you with some recommendations. I think all of you are familiar with it, the major changes being 6IMB lands, mineral in character, to all state lands, including submerged lands, and the addition of the reclamation section, which pretty much follows what we're doing now, looking at cooperation between DNR, DEC, as far in Fish and Game, as far as the tri-agency permits of today. This bill is not exactly like I'd like to see it, like the miners would like to see it, like the environmentalists would like to see it, like the House would like to see it, or the Senate would like to see it. But it's a balloon that's put together very carefully. A poke in one side can explode on the other. So I do support the Finance Committee substitute with the change in title and would ask your support.
Thank you, Senator Fahrenkamp. Any questions? Senator Frank, did you have a question?
More question or a comment than a question. I just would like to echo Senator Fahrenkamp's remarks relative to the compromised nature of the legislation. Clearly, it does not satisfy my intent or hopes for a bill from the miners' perspective, but I think it's a workable compromise that can gain enough support in both sides to work. And under those circumstances, I'm willing to support this legislation and would applaud the Resources Chair for her work in striking a bill that could be acceptable to all concerned.
Thank you. I have a question on the fiscal note, Senator Fahrenkamp. I've been following that pretty thoroughly.
I don't have the fiscal note here, okay. But I'm sure the department.
Okay, we'll go with that.
It's here, I think.
Thank you.
The fiscal note, I know, with this version, is much less than having than it would be if you had to identify the mineral and characteristics and. Therefore, you'll find a major decrease in your fiscal note.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman.
Bill Glue, did you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Glued from the Alaska Environmental Lobby. I'd like to register our support, too, for this compromise bill. As stated by the Resources Chair, this is not everyone's idea of the ultimate bill, but it meets a standard that everyone can live with. We are pleased to see that the reclamation question will be addressed over the interim and that legislation to address that question in more depth is recommended. We look forward to that as something that's necessary for environmental protection and also something that's necessary for the mineral industry as a condition for public acceptance. We hope to see full involvement of the miners in the reclamation process and thank everyone for their work on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. We have someone from the Alaska Miners Association that's here. Mr. Glanovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul S. Glavinovich. I do represent the Alaska Miners Association. basically in that organization. I'm the chairman of the special committee that has been responsible for this 6I, I don't want to call it problem, but resolution. As this committee is aware, the Alaska Supreme Court has found that the state's location system violated Section 6I of the Statehood Act, and that the state must charge rent or royalty on those mining claims located upon lands that were mineral in character at time of state selection. Now, the imposition of any rent or royalty system can drastically alter the financial equation of any existing mining operation, and also can create a strong disincentive to any future investment. With that in mind, the Alaska Miners Association participated in the current committee substitute that's before you today with two objectives in mind. The first, the legislation must satisfy the court's order. And the second objective is that legislation must minimize or must not jeopardize the impact of that court order upon existing mining operations and future mining operations on state land. My association believes that the current committee substitute achieves both of those objectives. And I must admit, if a year ago someone had told me I would sit here and ask you to favorably rule on legislation imposing rent and royalty on mining claims, my response would not be appropriate for this body. But having said that, the Alaska miners cannot philosophically embrace this legislation, and yet, in the interest of clearing the stage and moving ahead with the responsible exploration for and development of the mineral resources on state lands, we ask that you favorably pass this legislation on to the Senate floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I guess there's no questions.
Thank you
very much.
You ready for a motion?
No, I'm not. Mr. Gallagher?
Slow down there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Gallagher. I'm Director of Mining at DNR. And I guess to complete the round out the relative love in, the administration supports this bill. It's a good compromise. There is a fiscal note attached to it, I believe you have in your packet. I can go over that for a few minutes with you or just answer your questions.
I have some questions on the fiscal note. We have a new revised fiscal note, which is dated April 20th, 1989. What is the $240,000 which is in capital?
Yes, that's a one-time capital appropriation to allow the division to purchase a new computer system that will do a couple things. First of all, it will allow us to upgrade our records, record-keeping functions, our accounting functions, to provide for literally collecting 44,000 odd $20 bills every year, as well as help with the auditing and accounting of 200 royalty returns annually. This is necessary, obviously, to keep track of these claims. It is both for our use and it's for the public's use. The public routinely needs to know the status of mining claims. So that is the purpose of that. We do not have any specific computer picked out. We don't have a specific proposal to tell you about. The intent here, we've talked to four or five computer companies, IBM, Wang, that make these computers capable of this. We would like to go out to competitive bid, let them put a package together competitively that could fit our needs. That's the purpose of that.
Okay, and then on the $750,000 in royalty or revenue, the assessment, this was based on $20 for rent on producing claims?
That $750,000 is, right now there's 44,000 state mining claims. I made an assumption that even at $20 a claim, 20% of those mining claims would be dropped the first year, leaving 35,000 mining claims. At 20 bucks a claim, that produces $700,000 annually. The royalty calculation is a little more difficult, but out of 200 producing mines, I made a simple assumption of $50,000. So I think my estimates are conservative, and that's $750,000 annual increase to the general funds is quite accurate.
And the position that's in there is for somebody to handle the leases and royalties?
It is actually a, I'll have to check my notes here, but I believe it's a Range 12 accounting tech. It's somebody to actually enter the data into the computer. You know, some of these are permanent fund revenue. Some of these might be on mental health. There's quite a bit of allocation of funds, as well as do the receipting. We believe that with a new computer system, we can reclassify one or perhaps even two positions we have now within the division to do lease issuance, to do royalty accounting, these sorts of things. So this is another facet of the new computer that really doesn't show in the fiscal note. We think that we can use existing personnel to do the additional workload of collecting and processing all of this money.
Okay. Senator Fisher?
Just on the same thing, Mr. Chairman, you brought up. And you start looking at fiscal notes, in the first fiscal note you were going to buy this computer, the second you were going to rely on the department's computer. Now we're going back to buy another computer system. What's going to happen to the department's present computer system?
The department's revenue and billing system is the system that is utilized for actually tracking the money into the state's financial systems, allocating it to the different funds, whether it be the permanent fund or mental health accounting or whatever. The division keeps track of records for the public and the state agencies, and the computer system that we are looking at is for the division. The position would actually work on both sides of the fence to help with the state accounting system, but also help with land management records.
Then maybe I'm reading it wrong. The fiscal note of the 412, it says this process that you, in other words, you
Senator
took
Fisher,
out.
Senator Fisher, I do think we have a new one on April.
I realize that, Mr. Chairman, but what I'm wondering is, it seems like going back and forth. And just a question, so I, in my own mind, the last fiscal note had a lot of personnel service, but you dropped out you had contractual in there.
Right.
And under the contractual, you would be using, as I read this, a computer already in existence.
Now, the last fiscal note, and I'm sorry, I guess it's dated 412. I don't see it right here in my stack. But I believe that was attached to the CS in Senate Resources. I don't have it in front of me.
Let me ask you that.
Was a totally different bill. That required us to issue leases in a totally different way. That required us to do mineral and character determinations. That was a completely different bill than the bill you have in front of you. So there's no relationship between those two fiscal notes.
Senator Fisher?
No, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jerry. The fiscal note seems to be in order at this point. And the chair is now ready for a motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that we move out with individual recommendations. Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 129, Finance, with the attached fiscal note. And is there a letter of intent? It's not, huh?
I don't believe there is a letter of intent.
Let's see.
Is there objection to that motion and the movement of the bill? Did I wake somebody up at the table? Is that
like this kind of stuff?
Okay, there's no letter for 10.
She said something.
It's gone. We're not here.
What's that, Miss America? When Ben can do it, there she comes. You just made me know from the Keenan Miss America pageant in the Commerce budget or whatever it was.
Don't you
guys quit? Tonight I'll see theater people running over the place.
Yeah. that too heavy a gavel? Next bill on the calendar is, if we could just, I guess we just have to clear the gallery after that important bill passed out. Next bill, Senate Bill number 268. Senator Frank, an act relating to municipal finance and municipal joint assurance arrangements. Do we not?
268.
Okay. You should be honest. Good bill. Okay, Senator Steve Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill actually started a few years ago when the insurance markets became volatile and municipalities had a hard time acquiring insurance. The legislature approved the joint insurance arrangements so that they could pool together and self-insure. We passed that legislation, I think, in 1986, and this legislation would allow the joint insurance arrangement to issue debt to establish reserves, or to, if they had a multitude of claims in 1 year, to issue debt to stretch the payment for those claims over time. It allows them to further manage their risk, allows them to reduce their insurance premiums by having insurance reserves available. And it allows them, as I said, to more adequately take control of their own destiny in managing their risk. The bill specifically would allow them, as I said, to issue debt through the Municipal Bond Bank Authority, Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority. The debt issued would have to meet market tests, of course, and meet the approval of the bond bank. I think with that, I would be happy to answer any questions. We do have one proposed amendment offered by Mr. Wolforth, the bond bank's bond counsel, and we could either take that up at this time or after testimony.
Senator Frank, on page 4, on a question on it, loans to political subdivisions and joint insurance arrangements. What are we essentially doing on line 20 through 24?
This is where we involve the bond bank authority into being involved with the joint insurance arrangements. Up to now, the bond bank has just made loans to municipalities for, you know, for their general government purposes. Now they would be authorized to deal with the joint insurance arrangement of those member municipalities.
As I recall, the bond bank authority at this point has about only one or two employees. They have an executive director.
That's correct.
And they have like a secretary, and then they have like a Kelly girl in addition to that to do all that work. And I was just trying to think, it's probably one of the smallest entities in government I could think of. It's always been running real efficiently.
It is.
What is this going to do to their workload with that one?
It would be a relatively small or negligible impact. They would probably not do more than one or two issues per year. They do contract with bond counsel for you know, for the work that is necessary. So I see it as a negligible impact on the workload of the bond bank, and certainly not requiring additional manpower or anything like that.
Has Judy Brady had a chance to look at it?
She has. I understand that the bond bank is neutral on the legislation. they would act as a facilitator for issuance of debt. They're not necessarily promoting it, neither nor are they opposed to the legislation. We have today available to testify Mr. Bob Healy, who is the executive director of the joint insurance arrangement. And keep in mind, the joint insurance arrangement is a organization composed of member municipalities throughout the state. I think they have about 37 small municipalities participating now. They hope to have an additional 15 or 20 come into the organization this year. It's something that allows the municipalities to, as I said, manage their own risk and insurance needs together in a sharing of self-insurance.
Okay. There's an amendment from Mr. Wolford. Has that been added into the
No, it hasn't. It would need to. I would, if the committee's ready, I would offer an amendment. Offer the amendment. The purpose of the amendment was to include bonds in the list of acceptable debt instruments. It was an oversight when it had been left out of this version. It was in earlier drafts. The technical difference between a bond and a note, I'm not sure, but my general understanding is that a bond is of a longer term nature than a note. Notes are generally shorter term, and bonds are longer term. I don't know if that's the strict definitional difference, but anyway, it would just add bonds as acceptable debt instruments. And then on page 5, line 13, it makes it clear that there shall be a notice of default given in each instance of default. There is a mechanism in the bill that's in existing law that authorizes the bond bank to intercept municipal assistance, revenue sharing, other monies that flow from the state to the local governments if the local local government members don't pay their insurance premiums. So this protects the arrangement, it protects the organization if a member municipality doesn't pay its bill. And this would authorize them to intercept the flow of funds from the state to the municipality for a joint insurance arrangement debt, as well as their for the joint insurance.
Do we have Mr. Healy here to testify?
Sure.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Healy. I am administrator for the Alaska Municipal League Joint Insurance Association. As Senator Frank has stated, the purpose of this legislation is to enable municipalities singly or through the Joint Insurance Association to better control our destiny, to chart our own course through our pooled risk management arrangement. As a history of the problems that municipalities have faced in the insurance industry, in your packet there is a 33-and-a-half-year study by the Insurance Services Offices on insurance companies' underwriting profit and loss. That study pretty well tracks my 32-year career in risk and insurance. In risk and insurance parlance, the loss years are called crunches because this is when the market gets hard and it's a crunch on the part of insurers to find coverage at a reasonable price with reasonable coverage. The first crunch that really hit the public entities was that in the late 1960s, and that was due to the college and school fire losses. I can remember as an agent having to tell my small school districts who had no losses that their costs were going up 200% simply because the national losses were such. Again, the last crunch in 1984-85, I was risk manager for a large public entity in Arizona, and in 1985 we simply lost our insurance altogether. We could not get a proposal from the American market or London at any price.
the debt financing allows public entities to smooth out these insurance crunches, these large variances. The Society of CPCU Chicago chapter wrote an excellent monograph on debt financing for public entities and stated that the insurance cycle creates a problem in planning and budgeting for public entities. And the budget crunch comes from the fact that usually the municipalities have already set their budget for the following year, and then they get this wonderful notice from the insurance carrier that the costs are going up 300-400%. You can't go out and raise the mill rate. You have to reduce services. The last crunch in 85-86 really hit hard. There were communities around the country that simply closed their parks and beaches because they couldn't afford the insurance. We had one small town in Arizona, Clifton, that literally closed shop for 3 days. The mayor and the council said, nope, we haven't got any insurance. We're just not going to run anything. We won't take the personal risk. The state then bailed them out. Here in Alaska, Rich Underkoff, city manager from Soldotna, had commented that in 1985-86, over half of his property tax levy was for insurance costs. The CPCU article ended by commenting that the use of bond financing gives self-insured entities and pools the control over availability, capacity, definition, policy language, and solvency. And this pretty well states our case. Given this debt financing, we would use it in several ways. First of all, to augment, supplement, or complement our reinsurance, because when times get tight, we could buy less reinsurance and use more of our own assets. When the market is soft, as we call it, and we can get a good price from them, we would buy more from them and use less of our own. We would also use this to properly capitalize. Our current 37-member association was started in this soft market, and while we are funded for actuarial losses, there is simply no capital surplus. We have specific and aggregate reinsurance to meet the stop loss, but no reserve. Having these funds would enable us to set up a capital reserve, and if we were to get a big hit, rather than going out and assessing our communities, we could smooth it out over a period of 3, 4, 5 years and increase premiums slightly to pay the bond debt. This is called loss spreading, and it helps to smooth the budget. This also would give us negotiating clout with our current reinsurers, because then I could gently let them know that they're no longer the only game in town, that if we can't get a decent proposal from them, we'll do it ourselves. And that really is the gist of debt financing. It allows public entities to do more for themselves, to control their own destinies. And in recent years, states including California, New York, Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, Michigan, Washington, Maryland, South Dakota, Montana, Kentucky, and Illinois have passed this type of enabling legislation. There may be others, but these are the ones that I know of personally. And on that basis, we ask your consideration in favorable consideration of our bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Healy. The question I've got, having to do with the municipal joint insurance arrangement, how does that all fit together with the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank? Is that something that's going to be allowed to go through the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank during this bill?
The joint insurance arrangement is a pooled risk management facility that is currently in existence. What it would allow us to do would be to go to the Alaska Bond Bank to float the debt for us. And the bond bank would have the underwriting authority to either accept or reject. The Act does say that we could use other lenders, considering that many of our smaller members have no bond rating and never would. We would certainly get a more favorable rate, because we'll be unrated anyway, but we'd get a more favorable rate through